talks like an animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animals. Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest on today's show is Mac Chesnez, the environment reporter for the Tampa Bay Times, where he covers public lands, water quality, pollution, wildlife, and related issues. I'm a great admirer of Mac's work, and I'm hardly alone. He's a 2023 Journalism Fellow at Columbia University Center on Global Energy Policy and a recipient of several environmental writing awards. Thought it can make for a sparkling conversation to invite Max on the show to discuss some key stories he covered in 2025 and stories he anticipates will be significant in 2026. Ideally, as I mentioned in my invitation to him, we aim for that sweet spot where Max's Times beat intersects the talking animal's ethos. So this would likely include what we think, at least so far, maybe stories about tortoises in one scenario or another, a pod of dolphins who have learned to hunt alongside a Florida bow fisherman, pending legislation that could affect capturing endangered marine wildlife intended to display at aquariums or aquatic parks like SeaWorld, the bear hunt, and perhaps other topics spurred by comments and questions from you, the listener. So that conversation with Max Chesnez, who, by the way, is a license to fly drones, which we'll also probably get into, but I welcome him here in just a moment on Talking Animals on WMNF. Coming up later on today's program, I'll talk with Jessica Salmon, Communications and Marketing Director of Friends of Strays, St. Petersburg's oldest no-kill animal shelter, will give us the lowdown on some upcoming Friends of Strays events from the next edition of Cats and Mats Yoga coming up this Saturday to their big gala, Wags and Whiskers Cheshire Cat Ball, happening in March. So more on this and other Friends of Strays updates when I talk with Jessica later in today's program. Right now, though, let's get into our discussion with Mac Chesnez, chiefly about the notable Florida wildlife stories in 2025 and looking ahead again to what might be major such stories in 2026. With a reminder that I invite you to join this conversation, and we really do invite you to participate today, especially by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Mac Chesnez, the Talking Animals on WMNF.
Hey.
Good morning, Max.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me today.
Thanks for coming in. And I know it's not your first time at WMNF or even your first time on Talking Animals. Yeah. I know that last time you were here on Talking Animals, Bev was guest hosting.
Yeah, she was.
So
it's great to be back, though. I absolutely love this station and being on air. It's just a pleasure to be here.
Well, we love having you. So before we get into discussing some of the significant wildlife stories I mentioned, let's hear a bit of the Mac Chesnez story. So I read that you're a Florida native, and I just happen to know now, just from a moment ago, where you grew up. But let's talk a little bit about where you did grow up and kind of what was of interest when you were a kid.
Yeah, I am. So I am a lifelong Floridian, born and raised here. I grew up in Jupiter, Florida, born in West
Which,
Palm.
Which, again, is a weird coincidence just because I live in Jupiter Farms.
Yeah.
I'm like the freak guy that lives in Jupiter Farms.
Yeah.
And comes over to a show in Tampa. So.
And there must be some sort of correlation with people that live in Jupiter that have this sort of fascination for Florida environmental issues. I think it actually says a lot about the town itself. I mean, it's such an ecological gem. Like, I remember growing up and having the Loxahatchee River right there in my backyard, being able to kayak up and down Riverbend Park and being able to see this really scenic river in Florida. And then, of course, you had the Jupiter Inlet, right, where it spilled out into the Atlantic, and there was just so much wonderful fish and wildlife right there in Jupiter that it's just, I think I accredit my fascination to the outdoors to where I grew up. And of course, my parents were always really big about getting me outside. I as a kid in like middle school, I remember just spending sunrise to sunset, I'd be at the beach, surfing, swimming, hanging out with friends there, and just like really coming to love and know the environment of the East Coast. And, you know, there was always memories as a kid of when they'd open the floodgates of Lake Okeechobee, right, and send the discharges out towards the East Coast, and our Atlantic shores would be covered in sort of this, dirty brown fresh lake water, and always kind of wondering, like, what's that about, and why is this coast the recipient of Lake O discharges? So I just kind of became really fascinated with the area. And then, coincidentally, Jonathan Dickinson State Park is right there. And in Martin County, just over the Palm Beach County border, and really know intimately that park. I grew up camping and hiking in there, and that knowledge kind of came back around 2 years ago. One of the biggest stories we were on in 2024 was the proposal to develop a golf course on Jonathan Dickinson State Park.
Yeah.
So I think that knowledge of the park and, you know, having sourcing over there already from my previous environmental job, I was working at TC Palm, which is in Treasure Coast newspaper.
Sure.
So I was already pretty sourced up over there on the East Coast. And so,
you're on top of the story just because you already were so connected, right?
Just
because
I know so many people over there. And,
yeah.
And of course I know the park so well. The scrublands of Jonathan Dickinson are just have a very special and dear place to my heart. So, that was, that whole story was, also just personal for me and just being knowing that park so intimately.
And do you think you covered it in that way? And not only was personally you were familiar with it, and of course you grew up there, but also like seemed like some nefarious things, let's say, were going on in terms of the bid that got sort of halted once people got really an understanding of what was going on.
Hmm.
But I mean, that's how they got an understanding of what was going on, was people reporting on it.
Yeah, I mean, the Times broke the story in late August 2024 because we had received some documents from a whistleblower working for the Florida Department of Environmental Protection. And those documents showed, among other things, that the state had sort of been working on this plan to develop, to basically tear down the Hope Mountain Observation Tower, which if you've been to Hope Mountain before, it's like one of the tallest points in South Florida. It's this natural sand dune that overlooks the Atlantic and the Indian River Lagoon. And the plan called for tearing down that observation tower on the state park to build the golf course. And of course, people in Martin County and in Palm Beach County are already so dialed into environmental issues because of the Lake Okeechobee connection that there's already such a dedicated in environmental base there and Republicans and Democrats alike. Like, I mean, people across the political spectrum there and across Florida are really, tuned into these environmental issues. And so, that was just sort of a full circle moment for me being on that story in 2024. But yeah, that initial story that we broke kind of led to all these other tips and scoops for the period of, 2 or 3 weeks until the state, abandoned the plans. And then, of course, the sort of the final chapter of that whole saga was the passage of the State Park Preservation Act last year that basically will prevent any sort of development opportunities from happening again on any state parks.
I mean, really a ideal outcome for a story that began that way and had people kind of reeling because so much had already been put in place, as your reporting and others pointed out. It was like, Jesus, this thing is already getting away from us.
Yeah.
And then to have it, scotched and like now we're preemptively preventing anything like that from happening in the future. It was like,
yeah,
that's what happens with good, reporting and good sort of community.
Yeah, it was, I appreciate that. It was very, it was a effort across the board. I mean, there was, I think, thousands of protesters that came out over the course of 3 or 4 days. Honeymoon Island, I was out there for, 2 or 3 days in a row, covering protests, talking to, again, people on both sides of the political spectrum that just love Honeymoon Island and didn't want to see a pickleball court there. And, I know up in Anastasia State Park up by St. Augustine, there were, thousands of people on the sides of the road up there protesting the potential development of a hotel on Anastasia State Park. So it was really kind of beautiful thing to witness was the Floridians coming together in defense of our public lands.
And you've kind of, in telling a story, kind of outlined the virtues of being familiar with the territory growing up there, being totally steeped in the area in and around the center of the story. But I was going to ask you before, and I still will be, before we get to that point in the Max Chesnut story, at what point did you start to contemplate, on some level at least, the idea of scoring a job that would keep you on and in your beloved water over there and just keep you doing all the stuff that you loved?
Yeah, that's a great question. My sort of, origin story and how I really decided this is what I wanted to devote my life to. I think it really goes back to, the University of Florida, which is where I studied. I was sort of, going through school and trying to figure out, I knew I loved to write. I knew I loved science. Not a very good scientist. I'm not very good at math or chemistry. And, You know, in fact, I'm pretty sure
I understand those are sort of key to the whole thing, but it's just one person's opinion.
Pretty sure I dropped out of chemistry at UF. But I just was so fascinated by all this new research and about all these, you know, all this data coming out about Florida's environmental issues. And one day, a woman by the name of Cynthia Barnett came and spoke to one of our journalism classes, and she, you know, held up her cover story about the world's oceans in National Geographic. And I just remember that day, I was just being like, that is exactly what I want to do with my life. I want to be an environmental storyteller. I want to write stories about this, you know, beautiful and wild place and talk about all the people that are working to save it. And so I, you know, from that point forward, I kind of just, you know, was in her orbit as much as possible, in Cynthia Barnett's orbit, and just learning from her. And she was a great mentor and still is a great mentor. I talked to her all the time about environmental issues.
Where was she most of that time you were chasing her down? Was she at UF or was
she's an environmental journalism professor there. She has built a fantastic environmental journalism program at UF, and in fact they're actively raising money to continue the program there, and I encourage people that are, you know, supportive of environmental issues to look into that. But she's built such a great program, and you know, just this past week actually, Cynthia wrote, there's this bill moving through the Florida legislature this year to restore the Ocklawaha River, and Cynthia has a great story in National Geographic out about that bill and about the history of the Ocklawaha River and what it means to restore that river, and for the wildlife there, of course, for the community, and some beautiful images accompanying that article as well. And so her work continues to be an inspiration to me, and she's a great mentor, but I really do credit my origins to her. And I know there's, you know, some of my closest colleagues, both at, you know, our company and across Florida, that are environmental journalists, you know, attribute directly their rise and start to Cynthia Barnett. So she's a great environmental author, has a lot of great books out. Definitely encourage readers or listeners to check out her work.
Well, it's also great to be in that kind of department teaching that kind of thing. And your own work as a National Geographic, it's like, you know, as an inspiration, it's like you could teach a class, you say, this is how you approach the story or whatever. But then you flip open National Geographic and there's the latest thing that she's done. It's like, wow.
Yeah.
I want to be her and I want to keep going. It sounds like that's kind of what your sort of aha moment was.
Yeah, it was. I mean, and just, you know, reading good environmental stories too is just, it always gets me excited, really excited about the job, because in this business, there's, you know, there's highs and lows, and there's days when you're exhausted and the news just keeps coming and there's, you know, a million fires to put out. But then you read a really just strong and compelling piece of environmental journalism, and it just sort of reignites this flame within you from, you know, all over again. It's just the amount of environmental storytellers in Florida. We're so lucky in this state to have, you know, so many great journalists devoted to the beat. And you know, there's no shortage of news here at all on environmental issues, right? We have so many, you know, complex and unique issues from our water quality to public lands and to the kind of growing overdevelopment across the state. And, you know, the sort of ever-present contrast between economic growth and environmental preservation and what that means for a Florida that so many of us have, you know and love over decades. And so it's just it's a really great place to tell environmental stories. I'm so grateful for the job at the Times. And, you know, I've been a professional environmental journalist now, quote unquote professional, you know, full-time environmental journalist for, I think I'm coming up on like a year eight, you know, year seven. You know, before I came to the Times, my first real day at the Times was the day Hurricane Ian made landfall in Southwest Florida.
Welcome.
Yeah. But prior to that.
Grab your notebook and let's go.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, but, you know, prior to that, I was covering Lake Okeechobee and the Indian River Lagoon and the Everglades for TC Palm and Treasure Coast newspaper. So I kind of was able to, you know, cut my teeth on the beat, get to know a lot of sources that are really, you know, great scientists and researchers and advocates, and you know, I'm still doing that work today.
And I assume, based on the impact that you described that Cynthia Barnett had on you, for you it was always going to be environmental writing. Were there other aspects of journalism that also spoke to you, where you thought, well, maybe I could do that too, or I might do some additional stuff in this side of the journalism beat?
Yeah, I've thought about that a lot. About, you know, what if I wasn't on the environmental beat, you know, what would I do, you know, with my career? I mean, I'm so devoted to, you know, freedom of the press and the mission that a local journalist has, which is to, you know, inform and hold power to account. And so I, you know, that mission is still deeply rooted in me. And, you know, I love health and science reporting. I could see myself doing, something about, physics larger kind of deeper, theoretical questions of science and what it means for humans. But, just that intersection of complex research and the written word is somewhere where I'd, like to remain, the space I'd like to remain. But, you know, if the times will have me, I'll keep doing this job as long as I can, because I love the environmental beat. It's just, it's so unique.
Well, also another thing that seems like is critical to you about a lot of these stories, maybe this is a great way to get into one of our first ones that we were going to discuss today, which is one of two tortoise stories.
Yeah.
And because I think the story of a local woman named Maggie, is it Cirrus? Is that how you pronounce it?
Cirrus, yeah.
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 Maybe you want to talk about that, because it seems like that's a story that's about tortoises, yes, but it's really about her.
Yeah.
And somehow how much difference sometimes one person can make. And it seems like there's a number of those across some of the stories I've read of yours over the years.
Yeah, I think one of my sort of personal philosophies is just finding stories of individuals that are doing something to make a tangible impact. I think so often these environmental stories are complex and they're dense, and people can feel helpless of how to do something about it. And any opportunity that I get to spotlight somebody who is individually making a difference for wildlife, especially, is just such a sweet spot for environmental stories. And so I heard of Maggie last summer. She, I'm in a Honeymoon Island Facebook group where there's just a lot of devoted beachgoers there that are always sharing the latest news of the day from Honeymoon Island. And I kept seeing these posts of a woman holding up a sign, a big poster board, basically saying, slow down. And there's a picture of a tortoise on it. And I just was so fascinated by it. I was like, is she out there every day holding this up? Like, what's her story? I want to know what inspired her to do this. So I reached out to her, got her on the phone. We had a photographer go out and, sit with her while she was out there. And so basically Maggie's story is she heard, I think in June of last year, there was a big uptick in tortoise road kills at Honeymoon Island State Park. There are speed limits and signs posted at the park, but if you've ever been there, people are flying through there all the time to get to the beach and, breaking the speed limits by just hauling through there. And so, and so Maggie just had heard that there was an uptick of tortoise deaths. I think there was maybe, 10 or so in 1 month, and it was becoming a really big issue. And she's retired, and she just kind of got fed up by hearing about this and was like, I've got time to spare. I love this park. Go and figure out, I might as well do something about it. And so on the 4th of July weekend last year, she, created a poster board, a giant poster board that said, slow down, watch for tortoises. She got the approval of the rangers there to sit right in front of the toll booth with the sign. And she got, an umbrella. She'd be sitting out there for hours and hours and hours every day. Warning drivers to be on the lookout for wildlife, because you're in a, you're in a preserve area where there's a lot of wildlife crossing the road. And, she told him, the story she tells me is that there was a lot of, positive response from drivers. They would honk and cheer and roll down their window, and she would educate them about the tortoise population and got really incredible response. But, what made it even more magnificent was that she was actually making a difference. I think, the 2 or 3 months following Maggie's efforts, there was a dramatic decline in tortoise deaths in the park. I think there was only one killed for the entire month of either July or August. And so there was this sort of tangible proof here that just one human going out there and making that human connection with other drivers to let them know, hey, be careful for these tortoises, was enough to make a difference, just enough for people to kind of remember cognitively to slow down, because they saw a woman with a sign. And it just was so fascinating to me. And she's such a fun person to talk with. I just in November, the story has sort of had a life of its own since I wrote it, which is always a fun thing as a journalist, is to see work that you wrote, kind of be shared around the community. And I had a local elementary school teacher from Farnell Middle School send me an email like November last year, and she said, she'd read Maggie's story, she loved it, that she shared it with her class, the whole class loved it, and invited Maggie and I to come to the Great American Teach-In last winter to talk to the class. And And it was great. You know, the kids, like I told the kids a little bit about, you know, the importance of environmental storytelling and introducing the world to people like Maggie that are making a difference. And then Maggie spoke about the importance of wildlife conservation and advocacy and how you can make a difference as just one person. And so it's sort of beautiful lessons have come from this one story that I wrote. And, Maggie, a couple of days ago was named as a recipient of a wildlife advocacy award. She's going to be,
oh, great.
Yeah, she's going to be wow. honored for that. Next month. And so
fantastic.
Yeah. It's been great to just see how, one story like that can kind of carry on. And so I've learned from that reporting that, you know, my resolution for 2026 is, you know, my job is obviously to inform readers of, you know, environmental threats or, you know, major proposals going on, which can kind of seem daunting and overwhelming to a lot of people. But I also want to just kind of make a really intentional effort this year to tell stories of hope and inspiration and people that are actively making a difference for wildlife. Because I think, you know, there's so much news going on right now that is so, like, you know, overwhelming for so many people that it's good to be reminded that, you know, there is good out there and there's people that are making a difference.
Right. Yeah. There's Maggie's out there.
Exactly.
Yeah, and one thing that was cool as a little postscript to that is that I think she wanted to go visit grandkids or do something. So then someone took over for her, basically. Yeah. So I thought, there's not already a great person at the center of this story. There's now another great person at the center of the story kind of taking over for her when she was gone.
Yeah, I mean, she calls herself, you know, Team Tortoise. And, you know, she has these recruits now that when she's not able to be out there holding up a sign, that other people are happy to kind of stand in for her and take the reins when she's gone. So she sort of built this little movement inside the park of people that of wildlife advocates. And it's been fun to watch.
That's great.
Yeah.
All right. This is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Mac Chesnes, the environment reporter for the Tampa Bay Times. We're discussing significant Florida wildlife stories of 2025 and what may prove to be major wildlife or animal stories of 2026. So we absolutely welcome your questions or comments by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. All right, we'll come back to some stories, including yet another tortoise story in a moment, but let's pick up kind of our thread of the Mac Chesnes story. So you obviously talked about the incredible impact that Cynthia had on you. So did you love journalism yourself from the get-go? I mean, not counting, you're obviously inspired by her, but like, was it like, hey, man, this is exactly right for me. I can't believe it. I mean, this is clicking right off the bat.
Yeah, I guess if you'd asked me that question, you know, when I was much younger, I don't think I would have told you that I would have had plans to be a journalist. But, I did journalism in high school. I was on the high school paper. I was the news director of our TV station. So, like, it was something that I was always just drawn to naturally.
Yeah. Why do you think that was? What drew you back then?
I don't know. I think just communication, just being able to sit down with somebody and learn from them. I'm a kind of a curious person and just always want to learn from new people and learn about their worldview and, you know, what makes them tick. And so I've always been kind of drawn to that and making those larger connections with people. And so I for a while didn't think I would, you know, be able to make a living doing it, but being able to do that now and being able to find a job at a place like the Times that has such a great reputation of environmental journalists over the years, you know, Craig Pittman still out there breaking
for
environmental
sure.
news, was at the Times for so long. And, just being able to kind of carry on that legacy of environmental storytelling here now is such a dream come true. So, I feel like it all worked out like the way I, you know, it kind of maybe in the back of my head at the time was hoping it would, but, you know, was maybe a little too scared to make the full commitment and jump. And I just kind of got lucky getting, you know, took right out of college. I took a breaking news gig at TC Palm, just writing about crime and courts. And, you know, but my favorite story on that beat was about a, you know, rare northern cardinal that had this color mutation that made it yellow. And so, like,
Yeah,
they called it Sunny. It kind of became this local phenomenon. And, you know, bringing like a local wildlife story like that to the forefront was just kind of further validation that these wildlife stories are what I want to do for a living. And so luckily I just kind of the played my cards right, got really lucky, had a lot of great opportunities present themselves, and that's where I'm at where
well,
I'm at now.
That's great. I have more follow-up questions, but I think we have a caller that wants to get involved in the conversation.
Sure.
Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Max Chesnes.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to ask two questions. How do I get in touch with, is it Max Chesnes, and how do you spell Chesnes?
Yeah. You can, the best way to get in touch with me is via email. My work email is M as in Max. Last name is Chesnes, Chesnes, at TampaBay.com. That's if you have like a story idea or a tip, feel free to send me an email there. I'd be happy to take a look at whatever you want to chat about.
Also, I wanted to get in touch with Cynthia Barnett. I don't know if you've got the contact information, but who does she work for?
So she's still an employee of the University of Florida, the Environmental Journalism Program, but she does do she does write for a number of outlets, Nat Geo, namely. I'm happy to, if you send me an email, happy to connect you with her as well via email.
Although I will say, typically a lot of professor types, if you search their name, you can often get their
you can find their email, her email pretty
their
quickly. Yeah,
professional email pretty readily.
Yeah.
So.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks
for
your
call. So. It sounds like there was a long-standing potential zeal for journalism, and it sounds like once you got your hands into it, it's like, this is exactly what I was hoping it would be. Is there things that have changed over the years about what you love about it the most?
Yeah, I think maybe my answer about how accessible Florida government was to public records was a big draw for continuing journalism in this state, but that has obviously changed. There's sort of this culture now of inaccessibility and not handing over public records in a timely fashion from the current administration, which has been a very difficult hurdle, has made the job a lot harder, but, you know, also made us more creative and I think overall more well-rounded journalists. Like, we're better sourced now. People are giving us information knowing that we don't have direct access to it. So that has sort of, the dynamic of public records access has sort of changed the makeup of the job a little bit, but I don't know. I mean, like I said, I think like I really love, you know, breaking the bigger stories and informing Floridians of major proposals that could alter their, you know, beloved habitats and environments that they come to know. And that's like a big part of the job that I take pride in. But I think the one thing that I more you know, motivated now is those stories of hope that I mentioned, of just people that are making a difference, because I think that tends to resonate really well with audiences and readers. Like, I've got a story I'm working on right now. I'll give you a little inside
sneak
scoop
preview.
Here.
I was going to ask if we could get one of those.
Sneak
That's
preview.
Great.
Yeah. There's a 13-year-old named Callie Booth, who she could be the youngest person to have ever completed hiking the Florida Trail, all 1,000 miles of it from the Everglades all the way up to the Panhandle, and spoke with her and her family. Her dad just coincidentally was the former commander of the U.S. Army Corps over in the East Coast of Florida that I actually covered for a while. I spoke with him quite a bit about Lake Okeechobee issues over the years, and didn't know that at the time when I reached out to Callie and her family that was her dad. But it was kind of this funny full circle moment. But hearing Callie's story and how proud her dad is of, you know, he hiked a lot. He hiked it with her for 1,000 miles, and just hearing their story and what they saw throughout the kind of changes of ecosystems from the swampland to the uplands and pine forests. And just really excited to tell that story, write it up and bring it to a wider audience, because I think people will, you know, appreciate hearing that, you know, being 13 and hiking that is no small feat. And, you know, I think that's worthy of celebrating and sharing. And so that story is going to be coming soon. I'm still actively writing that right now.
Looking forward to that, because I guess Callie is not stuck on TikTok all day.
And like, you know, they shared fun stories of, you know, they would be listening to fun music and like they kind of expanded their music tastes together on the trail.
Oh, sharing songs back and forth. That's
sharing
great.
Songs and just like a kind of a great story of like, you know, a father and daughter connecting, you know, connecting together through our public areas, our public trails is just kind
right,
of
right and quite an arduous adventure. Not to mention,
they have some stories of you know, bad weather and, you know, trudging through like waist deep swamp water, and so there's like, it wasn't easy for sure.
Yeah,
you know, but
no, that's great.
They saw this great wildlife too, and just it's great to talk to them.
So that story's on the horizon. We'll keep an eye out for
Yeah, coming soon.
Cool. All right, so back to a story you did write. What I call tortoise number two, or sometimes I refer to it as flying tortoises.
Yeah.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about the the population, well, you could just say the Hurricane Helene tortoise story.
Yeah. So, you know, on the topic of gopher tortoises, I guess I kind of just honed in on those animals last year, just kind of naturally, because they're such a fascinating species and have such Florida, you know, Florida ties. Yeah, I'd heard kind of like through the grapevine that there was this population of tortoises on Fort DeSoto that, you know, weren't there before Hurricane Helene and were there now. And so there was a sort of fascinating tale of the night Hurricane Helene, you know, swept past Tampa Bay. Egmont Key, which is, you know, mile or 2 miles offshore Fort DeSoto, got inundated by storm surge. And that Egmont Key has a really bustling tortoise population. And so, yeah, it turns out that a lot of tortoises were swept up in the storm surge and, you know, survived miles of open water in this sort of very chaotic evening of really high, heavy, dangerous seas, and were washed up onto the mainland, onto Fort DeSoto, or onto the barrier island of Fort DeSoto, and are now surviving there, are now thriving. There's a new population on Fort DeSoto, and there's, you know, I spoke with the park ranger there, Anna Yu. She drove me around in her truck and showed me these burrows that the rangers are now tracking, that they know they're from Egmont because there was a biologist out there who over the years had sort of made this like a very unique marking on the shells of the tortoises to keep track of the population. And so that is what confirmed that they came from Egmont Key, was that they started seeing these markings on tortoises over on Fort DeSoto. And so to me, that was just so fascinating, right? Like, these animals endured such a kind of a scary evening. And, you know, the theory of how they got there is, I guess, somewhat disputed, like whether or not they were pulled in on debris or floated there. I think, you know, kind of the maybe the more popular theory is that, you know, these tortoises can float in the water to a certain degree. And so maybe they floated over in the seas. And then, you know, when they got there, some of the early rangers got back to the park after the hurricane, they saw a few of them on the shore, and some were like coughing up water and had clearly gone through this sort of chaotic journey. And then, you know, the rangers had to carry on and start clearing debris, and then, you know, circled back later to check on the tortoises. And sure enough, they were creating burrows along the park. And so just really fascinating, you know, the last couple lines of that story focuses on one specific tortoise who had created her burrow on like this high sand dune. And in the background of the burrow, you can see the lighthouse of Egmont Key from where she came.
Yeah, it was sort of almost like an impossible feat to go that high up, wasn't it?
There was a few tortoises that, like, you know, have burrowed really high in Fort DeSoto. And, like, kind of the joke from one of the biologists was, like, that was, like, their version of moving to Tennessee after a hurricane was because they, like, tried to get to the highest ground possible.
Not doing this again.
Yeah, never going through that again. Yeah. And so, like, a lot of them started burrowing way higher than normal, maybe because they, you know, have this recollection of this evening that they endured. And so just a really fascinating story, and there's so many examples of this in nature over the years. You know, the Madagascar, the lemurs of Madagascar, and how they got there, the theory is that they, you know, washed in from a storm event. The Galapagos tortoises, like, how did they get onto an island thousands or hundreds of miles offshore of the mainland? The theory is that they, you know, that there are these dispersal events throughout the course of natural history blew them in. And so it's just fascinating that we had one happen here in real time in Tampa Bay, and has sort of created this shift in the population now, where you have tortoises now on Egmont that survived the storm, and you have tortoises on Fort DeSoto where they weren't there before.
And again, another aspect of that story, which we see over and over, so many things, is how adaptable animals are. Something bad happens, they get injured, or they become airborne, or however they got from point A to point B in this story, and they react and they recover, and they just kind of pick up and where they left off.
Yeah, nature is very resilient. You know, that's one thing we can all learn from that story, is that these are strong animals. They've survived like, you know, millions of years on Earth, and there's a reason for that. It's because they're strong and adaptable. And but it's also, you know, they're up against the threats of humans now. We're doing a lot to change their habitats and environments, and we need to be mindful of that, you know, as we carry out our day-to-day lives, is how can we improve the lives of our natural native ecosystems and wildlife here. Is like, we have to work together with nature to make them stronger and more resilient. You know, they can do some of it on their own, but we need to help them.
Right, so, give them a leg up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Cool. Again, my guest is Max Chesnes from the... Tampa Bay Times. He's the environment reporter there. We're discussing some significant Florida wildlife stories of 2025 and looking ahead a little bit to what may be the similar kind of stories in 2026. Welcome your questions or comments by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So I'm going back to Max for a sec. So I was interested to see that you studied sustainability as well as journalism at UF. So can you tell me a little bit about that and the thinking behind it?
Yeah, so I was a double major at UF, a journalism degree and an environmental sustainability degree. And yeah, I think that's just in line with sort of my fascination for the Florida outdoors and environmental issues. Like, I learned a lot through the sustainability program, like these sort of sometimes philosophical questions of sustainability. You know, what is it? What does it mean? How do you compare economic growth and that tension with a sustainable future? What are some smart solutions that, you know, we can create right now to create a smarter and healthier Florida? One of our projects for that course was, you know, we created basically this walking trail through UF's campus, like an augmented reality walking trail that had different waypoints across the hike through the campus that showed different sustainable landmarks, like LEED certified buildings and you know, natural landmarks on UF's campus that that are notable and worth kind of highlighting. And so that was a major project we did through that program. And yeah, I just learned a lot about like sustainable initiatives in Florida. Our professors were really well-rounded and had really good perspectives on you know, food insecurity, public lands issues, like you name it, across the board. I learned so much from this program. And then at the same time, I was, you know, was writing stories for the Independent Florida Alligator, the school newspaper. So like finding, you know, these stories through my studies and the sustainability side of things really informed my writing on the other side. So it was kind
That's great.
A perfect blend of the two that really helped create where I am today, you know?
Yeah, they really kind of served each other.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, so happy to have done that.
Yeah, no, that's smart and interesting and serve you well, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
absolutely.
All right, so let's talk about another story. This is the about the pod of dolphins who learned to hunt alongside a Florida bow fisherman.
Yeah.
I mean, that to me, that's interesting on so many levels. So why don't you give the basic story, and then we'll maybe get into some of those levels.
Yeah, so I learned about his name is Captain Justin Diamond. He's a bow angler. You know, he uses a bow and arrow to hunt fish up in the Crystal River area. And a friend of mine, Elizabeth Bonnert, she's like a local wildlife artist here. She is friends with Justin and had gone out on the boat with him because she does some marine mammal research and work on the side, like volunteer work. And she had told me about Justin and how, you know, he'll go out at night. There's no other boats out. He has these really bright lights on the bottom of his boat to sort of illuminate the seafloor to help him look for fish. And, you know, starting about a decade ago, he would turn on these bright lights and pods of dolphins would start kind of gradually coming to his boat. They would use the lights of his boat to that would sort of briefly stun fish, and they would learn to kind of hunt alongside of Justin. And it was so fascinating because I went out with him on a boat with a bunch of UF researchers last fall, a couple months ago now. And, you know, he turned on the sun had already gone down. We were out in the Gulf at this point, and he flicks on the lights and he's like, you know, basically like countdown from, you know, 2 minutes and see what happens. And sure enough, like he flicks on the lights, and then within probably, you know, 90 seconds or something, 3 minutes, you hear the first blowhole. This dolphin approaches, and within minutes you had, you know, a dozen dolphins, maybe two dozen dolphins surrounding the boat. And he would just drive up and down the flats of the Gulf we were with him for like 4 hours that night, pretty late night, but the dolphins never left his side. And it's sort of this kind of mutually beneficial relationship between the two of them. Like the dolphins are using his bright lights to hunt, and they feed, and they've sort of learned this behavior to hunt alongside him. But then on the other side of the coin, the dolphins will actually push fish towards the shore and make it easier for Justin and his clients to hunt fish. And so they're sort of hunting together. And there's a few...
And in a real sense of cooperation, it seems kind of fascinating to me.
Yeah, and I think, like, you know, the scientific term that the researchers are calling it is, like, the dolphins are, quote, you know, exploiting the anthropogenic influences of
wow.
of Justin's boat.
Rolls right off your tongue.
Yeah, which, it, you know, in layperson's terms is basically, like, you know, they're just taking advantage of the lights and the stunning of the fish to their own benefit, and, you know, they're not really cognitively thinking, like, oh, I'm going to go help Justin hunt, but that's what they're doing naturally. And so it's this really kind of interesting relationship. And Justin, for so long, you know, when this was going on, he was like, I think I have something special here. Like, this behavior is rare. You know, I'm not really sure if this is normal or not. He reached out to a lot of scientists, and he didn't really have much luck at first getting any interest from the scientific community. And then one day, Dr. Stephanie Gosda at UF, she leads like a marine mammal program over in the Nature Coast. He reached out to her and was like, I just, you know, please just come out on the boat for one night and take a look at this. I think there's something special here. She heeded that call. It was the first one to really go out with him. And she told me, you know, that the first night she was out there, she was like, wow, there is something special to this relationship. And they've been studying it now for a couple of years. Like, they're taking samples from the blowholes of the dolphins. They're studying their health. They're studying the behavior and what it means for the population, learning a lot about these animals, this specific pod of dolphins that's learned this behavior. It's just such a fascinating story. And there's a few global examples. They think this is the first example of like a pod of dolphins learning this behavior, specifically like using bright lights from a bow fishing boat. But there's other examples across the world of pods of dolphins, you know, either, you know, swimming alongside a trawling boat and trying to capture the bycatch. And there's some interesting examples across the world of this. So to have one again kind of right here in our backyard in Florida is just a kind of another Florida-only story that's really unique. It's just really fascinating. He's a great character. Justin's a really a fun guy to be around. Like, there's no one really that knows that ecosystem better than him. And so he's always very... mindful of changes in the ecosystem. And, you know, he's also mindful too, which I really appreciated. He's like, you know, I've hunted a lot of fish in my time here, and like, I want to give back now to the community by letting the scientists come on board and study the animals. And so anytime he takes the scientists out, it's like on his dime and on his time. Like, he gives everything to them for free, gives them the opportunity to study these animals. That's sort of his way of giving back to the ecosystem that he's, you know, he's taken from for so long.
And it's another example of an individual, like, at the center of a story like this. But in this case, he obviously uncovered kind of an animal phenomenon that he realized was indeed a phenomenon.
Yeah.
So he wanted to see it continue and be recognized, and now it's sort of part of a research study. So,
yeah.
I mean, again, it's sometimes... individuals are just so significant in this way.
Yeah, and like, you know, one thing Cynthia would always tell us was like, you know, all environmental stories in Florida are human stories inherently. Like, there are always humans at the center of these environmental issues. And so how do I, as a reporter, find those humans at the intersection of wildlife and ecology? And you'll find that there are so many people in this state that are focused on really niche species, right? Like, that's my sort of my favorite crossroads, is finding somebody who's like the one expert on like a rare Florida flower, for example. Like, being able to tell that story is so unique. So yeah, any story in Florida is a human story. Any environmental story is a human story. There are humans directly involved, and so being able to write those is like the main mission, you know, at the times.
So we're nearing the end of our time, Max, believe it or not. So there's been some nice emails, which I may or may not have time to read, but some are responding about Maggie. Some just enjoying the show. And one that I think came in from the guy that called about identify you again and your
sure.
contact information. So we'll do that before we say goodbye today.
Okay.
But before we go, looking ahead for a story that's going to be significant, can you talk a little bit about the whole FWC, the bill, I guess, that would ban the longstanding practice of...
Oh, yeah.
...legal capture of endangered marine wildlife. That's got too much complication for us to probably get into now.
Yeah, I can...
We should at least address it, because it is important, I think.
Yeah, I can briefly touch on that. So there's a bipartisan measure moving through the Florida legislature right now called the MANTA Protection Act. It's an acronym, MANTA. But basically, this legislation is directly in response to... There was a viral video last year, a dolphin tour boat operator up in the Panhandle area, like near Panama City, filmed a crew basically capturing a threatened manta ray with a huge net and throwing it into like a kiddie pool on their boat. And it just immediately sparked all this widespread outrage. Like, how were these people allowed to capture this? Was this illegal? There were so many questions. And then, you know, the state's wildlife commission, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, came out and said, you know, this was a legal capture under our special activity licensing program. They were allowed to do this. We permitted them to do this. And it turns out that that manta ray, was captured for a SeaWorld in Abu Dhabi, you know, across the world. And so, this sort of that, because of that viral video, like, it really spotlighted this, you know, very little known but longstanding practice in Florida where the state was allowing the legal capture, is still allowing the legal capture of endangered and threatened marine life, like manta rays and sharks. And so lawmakers were really kind of shocked by that. Like, I mean, across, like, Lindsey Cross is a Democrat here in St. Petersburg, but there's also Ileana Garcia, I think, and she's a Republican out of Miami, and they both have filed their own version of bills this session to ban that practice, to ban the legal capture of endangered and threatened marine life in Florida waters. And so it's interesting interesting story that we're following. I think it, you know, very has a lot of very visceral reaction because of that video. And, you know, major kudos to that the people that filmed that video, because yeah. I don't think we wouldn't have really known the scale of this whole program had they not really shined a light on it. So I think there's a good lesson there, and like, for if you sure. see something, to document it
right whenever you can.
Yeah
All right, Max, well, sorry, I hope you'll come back and we'll do more of this, because we didn't get to quite as much as I hope we did, but sure. I had a feeling that might happen.
Yeah, there's a lot
sort
to cover.
Of a good problem to have, and so I hope you'll come back. This has been Max Chesnes from the Tampa Bay Times, and again, his email for story ideas, tips, etc. is mchesnes, C-H-E-S-N-E-S at tampabay.com, and doing great work, obviously, over there. And we'll hopefully talk more about it next time you're here. And thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
In a moment, I'll speak with Jessica Salmon of Friends of Strays. Right now, though, we're going to step into the comedy corner with a piece sort of relevant to the conversation we just had with Max. Here's Touching Turtles from Drew Lynch in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
I took a trip pretty recently. I was in Hawaii, as you can see from my mom shirt. And I, right when my plane landed in Hawaii, one of the flight attendants was like, "Hey, just so you know, you cannot touch the sea turtles here, or they will fine you up to $10,000." And I was like, "I don't appreciate you assuming that I have a history of touching turtles." I don't like that I was the only person she told, either. I was like, you think I'm the guy? I give a strong turtle touching vibe for you? Know your market. Why don't you tell me, what part of a turtle looks fun to touch at all? You think I was like, I can't wait to rub its bald head, run my hands over that dirty igloo it's carrying. I never wanted to touch a turtle until she told me I couldn't. Now I'm curious. I'm like, why? Will it cure me? Why? $10,000, man, for touching a turtle. Immediately, I was like, what's the fine for spanking them, do you think? Is it the same? How hard is a touch until it's in spanking territory? I mean, a spanking underwater, that's got to feel like a touch, wouldn't you say?
That was Drew Lynch in today's Comedy Corner with a piece called Touching Turtles, taken from an appearance at the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival in Montreal. Right now, we're going to speak with Jessica Salmon from Friends of Strays. Fill us in on some upcoming events at the shelters holding and other updates. So let's hear more now by welcoming Jessica Salmon, the Talking Animals on WNO. Hi, Jessica.
Hi there. It's great to be here.
Great. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. So let's start figuring, some listening may not be as familiar with Friends of Strays as some of us are. Maybe you could just provide a brief overview of Friends of Strays, a bit of the history, the mission, and so on.
Absolutely. So Friends of Strays is St. Pete's oldest no-kill shelter.
We've been around since 1978, and we were established by a wonderful community leader named Jean Momonti. Since that time, we have grown considerably from, you know, from what was at one time a volunteer operation to an animal shelter with a brick-and-mortar facility, and we help save the lives of more than 4,000 animals a year through our TNVR and our adoptions program. Last year alone, we completed over 2,000 adoptions, which was a shelter record for us, and we're very proud of that.
Wow, that's great. So how do all those various efforts that Friends of Strays maintains, how do those typically get funded?
So as a nonprofit, we're entirely dependent on our community for funding. We believe that love saves lives and that everybody can take part in saving those lives. So, you know, each one of those lives that we were able to save last year was made possible through donations from our community and our corporate partners. You know, every single dollar helps us, you know, be able to say yes to another animal in need.
And I guess, obviously, some of these events that you guys hold helps bring in some monies that help keep the machine going.
Absolutely. Events are a great way for people to kind of learn more about us, you know, do something fun with their spare time, as well as, you know, support our mission and our cause.
So more immediately, you've got another session of your ongoing Cats and Mats Yoga that's happening this Saturday, January 24th. And there's other things coming up. Anything you want to mention, then we'll get into the big kahuna.
Yeah, so Cats and Mats is a really fun opportunity for any level of yoga enthusiast, whether you've never done a yoga class before or, you know, you're a seasoned professional. We partner with the Velvet Mat to bring an instructor into our amazing community room at our cat box. And for an hour, you get to, you know, try to do some yoga while also getting distracted by adorable kittens. It's a really fun time. It's a great way to, you know, be active while also, you know, helping cats and dogs in need, as well as, you know, getting to meet some adoptable kittens.
That's great. Without mentioning any prizes, because we're not really allowed to, let's talk briefly about the Wags and Whiskers.
Absolutely. So Wags and Whiskers is our annual fundraising gala. This year's theme is called the Cheshire Cat Ball, and it is on March 14th. At a new location this year, we're going to be at the Lealman Exchange Community Center. So we're very excited to partner with another local organization to host this event. It's going to be a great time. Our gala is really more than just an event. It's an opportunity for us to celebrate the lives that we've saved, as well as a way for us and our supporters to commit to saving more lives in the future, as well as it's just a fun time. You know, there's drinks, dancing, great silent auctions. Our baskets and things are always a lot of fun. And our themes are fun. So we always have fun on theme surprises. You just never know what you're going to get at one of our galas, and it, you know, you're going to have a good time regardless.
That sounds great. So that's Saturday, March 14th. And again, people can go to friendsofstrays.org to find out more about the events we're talking about, including the gala and anything else about Friends of Strays, including some of their great adoptable pets they have available right now. So, Jessica, absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us on Talking Animals.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
You too. Thank you. All right, coming up on WMF, it's The Conversation, the great show hosted by Mario Nunez and Joe King Carter. After that, it's The Scoop, WMF's brief news recap. Then we shift back into music programming with Sam Vaughn, holding forth from 1 to 3, followed by Nancy C, hosting the Traffic Jam from 3 to 6 p.m. And then it's all great music and more of the great stuff on 885 WMF. So my guest next week will be Miguel San Juan, an animal control officer with Hillsborough County, and we'll discuss various aspects of serving as an animal control officer and a lot of the misconceptions that people have, I think, about that kind of job, and just find out more about it all together. So that's next Wednesday here on Talking Animals on WNF. So that's all for today. It's Talking Animals on WNF Tampa 88.5 FM. Thanks.